From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This century is very likely to see a huge handoff of power between the United States and China. Maybe they're co-equals. Maybe China's number one. Either way, it's a change so big, Americans have hardly begun to take on board its implications. But Lee Kuan Yew has, the Grand Master Statesman of Asia. Now, two Americans have pulled together the Grand Master's view. This hour, On Point, reading Lee Kuan Yew on the real road ahead for the U.S. and China and more. You can join the conversation. Is the U.S. ready for what's coming in this century? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. 89-year-old Lee Kuan Yew was Prime Minister of Singapore from 1959 to 1990. He's been a confidant and guide to Chinese leaders and American presidents for decades. Now he's thinking about both countries and more. His thinking has been collected by my two guests today. With me in the studio, Graham Allison, worked for Secretaries of Defense under Presidents Reagan and Clinton, Director of the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Graham Allison, welcome. Great to have you here.
Thank you.
Also with me, Robert Blackwell, former U.S. ambassador to India, was National Security Advisor for Strategic Planning under President George W. Bush, a senior fellow for U.S. Foreign Policy at the Council on Foreign Relations. Ambassador Blackwell, Bob Blackwell, welcome.
Thank you.
Together, from their interviews with Lee Kuan Yew and Lee's speeches and more, they have drawn the new book, Lee Kuan Yew, the Grand Master's Insights on China, the United States, and the World. Graham, why have you gone to this man? You quote all kinds of people in the front of the book saying he's the smartest guy on the planet. Why have you gone to Lee Kuan Yew? Why is his view of what's happening between these two great powers and more worthy of this great compilation?
Well, it's a very good question because one wouldn't usually imagine doing such a thing. But if you ask about the most important questions geopolitically for Americans today and for the rest of our professional lives, who in the world is most qualified to have thoughtful answers? I think the answer has to be Lee Kuan Yew. And there's several reasons why. First, he's very smart strategically. But secondly,
founder of Singapore, he led knows it for years and years, still engaged there at 89.
Absolutely. Secondly, he knows something about the rise and fall of nations. He actually rose a nation, which was a poor, corrupt, to first world status in a single generation.
Singapore from almost nothing to like $50,000 a year
richer,
median income.
Richer median income than Americans.
So he's got a track record of success.
And so he's not just theoretical about it. Mm-hmm. Thirdly, as you said, he's been called mentor by Deng Xiaoping, the guy that started China's march to the market. Mm-hmm. And every successive Chinese leader, including Xi Jinping, the current leader, mm-hmm. and every American president has reached out to him as counselor. He's the only person, actually, Henry Kissinger is my old professor at Harvard. He's the only person I've ever heard Henry say, only living person, from whom he said, this is the smartest strategic guy and I've learned a lot from him. So I would say he's well positioned to have views about this. And because he lives in a small Singapore, mm-hmm. which survives by being alert and agile and adjusting to changes in the current, changes in the winds, storms coming, he has a serious motivation to watch these trends because Singapore only survives by somehow navigating. They can't make any waves. They just ride them.
Yeah. And now we may have to navigate very assiduously as well. An Asian leader who stops off at the White House because U.S. presidents want to speak to him, who knows Chinese leaders. They come by and talk to him. He sees them as well. Ambassador Blackwell, Bob Blackwell, in Asia, how is Lee Kuan Yew seen?
He's the most admired man in Asia. I think without any doubt, the most admired living Asian. And that's because of the reasons Graham said earlier, but also as we had these conversations with him, I want to stress, at 89, mm-hmm. he's as smart as ever. And perhaps because he's 89, in the book, he's just enormously candid as to how he sees the future of China, the future of the United States, the future of the U.S.-China relationship, and so forth, and more candid than he's ever been in print before. And that's terrific because it allows all of us to gauge our own views against what he says about these major issues that face the United States, China, and the world.
And we need candor right now. I mean, it's hard to get your head around the scale of changes going on right now, what that may mean in this century. David Ignatius calls Lee Kuan Yew the smartest politician he's interviewed in his career as a journalist. You quote Nick Kristof. I mean, he's a complicated character as well. You have people who you can't help but admire Singapore's development. It has been great. He also gets criticized by non-Confucian leaders for being sort of authoritarian, not dictator style. But in Singapore, Nick Kristof writes about him, one can disagree with him, but intolerance and authoritarianism have never had so articulate or stimulating a spokesman. Calls him an extraordinary man, smart, thoughtful, blunt, and provocative. He knows the United States very well and has been a friend to the U.S. He knows China very well and carries a lot of Chinese culture in his own management of Singapore. Here's Lee Kuan Yew. This was from 2009. Just to begin to get a sense of where he sees the world turning, no surprise, it's toward China and the Pacific. Here he is talking with Charlie Rose 4 or 5 years ago.
The 21st century will be a contest for supremacy in the Pacific, because that's where the growth will be, that's where the bulk of the economic strength of the globe will come from. Now, if you do not hold your ground in the Pacific, you cannot be a world leader.
Lee Kuan Yew in 2009, and there he's only talking about the Pacific. Big as that may be, it's really the whole world that's on the table. You, Graham Allison, and Robert Blackwell brought a lot of questions to Lee Kuan Yew. Some of them he answered directly in interviews. Other of this you've pulled out of his speeches and his public presentations. And let's just cut right to the chase. I mean, you ask him, you know, are Chinese leaders serious about displacing the United States as the number one power in Asia and the world? His answer, Graham?
Well, directly, as you said, he says, quote, "Of course. Why not? Who could imagine otherwise? How could they not aspire to be number one in Asia and in time the world?" And then he goes on to say, looking at the track record of this last 30 years in which China has risen further and faster on more dimensions than any country in history, he says, quote, "This reawakened sense of destiny is an overpowering force."
He's looking at the years in which China was down after thousands of years in which it was the power in its world, Asia. Everybody talks about China's economy, Bob Blackwell, but this sense of destiny that he talks about in China now, that is powerful fuel in itself.
It certainly is, and it's reflected in the blogs that one looks at in China, the sensitivity of the Chinese government to this growing nationalist feeling of pride based not on imagination, but on accomplishment. No other country has done what this country has done in three decades. And one of the strong points Lee Kuan Yew makes is that he urges us not to use historical analogies about the rise of China, as we, all of us, tend to do.
Analogies like what?
Well, like this might be like the rise of Germany at the end of the 19th century, and what can we learn from that?
Mm-hmm.
What Lee Kuan Yew says is there's never been anything in the history of the world like this. 1.3 billion people located where they are with an ancient civilization
proud,
growing
deep,
proud, deep, growing at 10% a year for the last 30 years, and those economic projections more or less are probably the most likely economic course for the future. So what he says is we have to think about this in new and different ways. It is going to rebalance the international system.
Wherever this goes, it's going to be profound. But the nuances may matter here. And in your telling of his view, on the one hand, he says it is China's intention to be the greatest power in the world. That sounds like number one. But he also says the Chinese will want to share this century as co-equals with the U.S. So which is it? The greatest power in the world, number one, or co-equals with the U.S.?
I think it matters of the timeline. What he says frequently in the book is for the next 20 to 30 years, the Chinese understand that it would be not in their interest to challenge the United States directly as they get stronger and stronger and stronger. So he doesn't foresee military conflict between the two or anything like that. But you take the timeline out further, and now China stronger and stronger and stronger. And an important dimension of this, which we'll discuss, mm-hmm. is what's going, and he mentioned in the Charlie Rose comment, what's happening with America during this period. Mm-hmm. If America weakens and China strengthens during this period, then you have a rebalance of power in Asia, and China is the most important power in Asia, does have Asian primacy.
Long-term, number one in the world, maybe even if the U.S. pulls up its boots, Graham. You know, our image from history is of the foreigner required to kowtow, literally pound their head on the floor in front of the Chinese emperor to show they're the vassal, he's the guy. Co-equals or China is number one? I also kind of read him saying that they're going to have to exist as co-equals, even if one may have more raw power, economic and otherwise.
Oh, it's an extraordinarily good question, and you're getting at the subtleties of it. I think that he warns, actually, in the book, he's got a very interesting warning, which he's also given the Chinese leaders, that the circumstances are such that the aspiration to be number one in a world in which you also have a powerful U.S. Mm-hmm. and a powerful China and maybe a powerful India is going to require them to think differently than the traditional Chinese image. But he says the image that he thinks is at their core is the notion that the way things used to be before colonialization and humiliation, in which that's where kowtow came from. Other people came there, they kowtowed,
and China was
vassals,
the center of the universe.
We've
got to take a short break here. We're thinking about this century through the words of Lee Kuan Yew with Graham Allison and Bob Blackwell. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the world's most senior statesman, strategist out of Asia, Lee Kuan Yew, and the new world of power he sees in the 21st century. China up, the U.S. uncertain, and what that will mean. Graham Allison and Ambassador Robert Blackwell have put together the thoughts of Lee Kuan Yew over a number of years, maybe the most admired statesman in Asia, certainly maybe the world, just leader after leader who wants to talk with him. Today, we're getting the advantage of how he sees the century that's coming. Their book is Lee Kuan Yew, The Grand Master's Insights on China, the United States, and the World. You can join the conversation this hour. Have you started to think about what it will really mean if, when, China moves ahead of the U.S.? Is that now inevitable? How will it change the world? And will the U.S. and China be co-equals? How will that work? Will the U.S. have to learn to bow on values, on interests? We're at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Lee Kuan Yew, 89 years old now, but still very active in Singapore, which he helped found after its colonial period, led for decades. In 2008, he talked with Fareed Zakaria about things he liked and didn't admire about the United States, things we may have to pay careful attention to, he's suggesting, if we want to keep up in this century.
Do I want to be like America? Yes, in its inventiveness, in its creativeness. But do I want to be with America, like America, with its inability to control the drug problem? No. Or the gun problem? No.
Or the deficit problem, he adds to that these days? No. Lee Kuan Yew there in 2008. He's still going strong. Graham Allison and Robert Blackwell join me in the studio. You asked him, what is China's strategy for becoming number one? Bob, what's his reply?
He thinks the engine of Chinese strategy, and it's been true for 25 years, is the growth of the Chinese economy, which allows them to have greater and greater influence on Asia and beyond. And here's what he says. He says, many medium and small countries in Asia are concerned about this ever more powerful China. They are uneasy that China may want to resume the imperial status it had in earlier centuries and have misgivings about being treated as vassal states. Chinese expect Singaporeans to be more respectful of China as it grows more influential. They tell us that countries big and small are equal, that they are not a hegemon. But when we do something they do not like, they say, you have made 1.3 billion people unhappy. Mm. Know your place.
Know your place. What What does that mean for the United States, Graham? I mean, their strategy is to do this, sort of keep their head down now, this sort of harmonious rise, right? Smiling as they go.
Peaceful rise and peaceful, smile.
Yes. But that, as Lee Kuan Yew points out, and you convey, that enormous economic power is raw power. It is already reconfiguring countries in their neighborhood around them and beyond around them. So how does the United States fit into that picture? Does the Chinese sort of fundamental structure of viewing the world require one country at the center and the others as vassals? Can they picture co-equal?
Well, I think that that's the question he points us to. And as Bob said earlier, he says historically, we know in the Thucydidean story that a rising power that rivals a ruling power requires a lot of attitude and action adjustment on both parties if it's going to turn out successfully. And he looks at the U.S. as it rose and at Germany as it rose, and the Chinese have looked at those. And then he says, yeah, but imagine a country, just as Bob said, had 1.3 billion people and had not just emerged over 100 years, but had emerged over 30, 40, 50 years. Well, their strategy has been keep your head down, smile. As he says in the book, when they first talked to him about peaceful rise, he said, nobody's going to believe that. You know, I don't think that's a very good idea. He said, well, they use the term anyhow, so that's what it means. But I think that he imagines that the Chinese will have to have some major attitude and action adjustments from their historical imagery because he thinks and hopes the U.S. will be a strong power. He wishes India would be a strong power. He would like for Japan to be a strong power, so there'll be some balance to China, even though recognizing, as Bob said before, that this is going to be a world balance looking entirely different. So one of the very interesting things I found, if you look at the chapter on globalization in the book, he's way, way, way out beyond any conversation you would hear among politicians in the U.S., whether it's about global warming and how in the world people couldn't, you know, as a globe, get together on that topic to global power balances where one's going to be imagining something.
To free trade all over. He says, USA, you better be free trading with everybody in Asia or you won't have a chance to hold back China's dominance there.
He thinks that the Trans-Pacific Partnership proposal that's now, as he says, 30 years ago, that would have been brilliant. But now it's getting late. Yeah.
You know, it's not as though this economic rise is just something soft or like Switzerland. I mean, you quote him saying the Chinese leadership has learned that if you compete with America in armaments, you will lose. You will bankrupt yourself. So avoid it. Keep your head down and smile for 40 or 50 years. And then if things continue to go their way, if they don't trip, if we don't do better, and he says we've got to do better within maybe 10 years or so, we got to get up on a better path. You've got a real shift. We've got lots of listeners calling in. David in Chesapeake, Virginia. David, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
You know, this is a really interesting topic, and I had this similar discussion back in 2005, and you know, when China and was taking a huge step in the building arena, and you know, buying up supplies and so forth here in the United States
to
be shipped to China. Well, this is the way I kind of see it. You know, you have China where, you know, as the, for years, you know, the American government, or I should say the United States, has been so fearful of anything communism, whereas you have China, who has been very strict in their culture and their government and how they've kind of handled things over the years, and little by little they relax those that tight rein that they have on their society, and so it allows it to grow and grow and grow, whereas in the United States, we've been so lax and have, you know, like 1,000 different groups of people in society and business doing all their own things, you know, doing the things that, you know, 1,000 different systems all doing something different, trying to attain the same goals or whatever, and you know, so everything's kind of been more lax or less restraint, and now we're running into all these problems where we are being forced to have to restrain everyone to get a grip on it, whereas China can just relax theirs and keep on getting it.
David, that is interesting. You sound like a Confucian in the making there. Confucius would like being drawn to order in that way. But I know what you mean. Lee Kuan Yew is watching both. David, thanks for your call. He's watching these things very carefully, the cultures of both countries, the problems they can produce in China. And he does point to problems there. The advantages, and we heard him say, of inventiveness that can come with do your own thing in the United States. What about the cultural meeting of these two great powers and how that positions them in terms of power, Bob?
Well, the values issue, which is, of course, at the heart of the culture, is one which he thinks is not going to be bridged. And quite controversially for especially Americans, he says democracy is not going to come to China, period. He says there's nothing in China's history or culture, Confucian past, which will lead to that. But he goes
maybe
further.
Little bits at the fringes, but fundamentally no.
Fundamentally no. And he goes further and says if China tried to enact the kind of democracy that Americans urge on them, China would come to pieces.
Mm-hmm.
So beware of what you wish for if you're an American with respect to democratizing China.
Well, so here's the new number one, maybe, or at the very least, a co-equal, and they're not going to embrace democracy. Graham, that means globally. They're certainly not going to export democracy. This is a real shift in global values. I think a lot of Americans have forgotten just how much the familiarity and the hominess of the world has been shaped by American power.
I think you're exactly right, and there's just layers and layers of complexity here. But I would say that in the first instance, Lee Kuan Yew is a great admirer of American culture versus Chinese in the sense that the American culture is individualistic, competitive, and rewarding initiative. So he's mesmerized by American inventiveness, and he thinks that's a huge, huge cultural strength. Secondly, a country that can actually attract talent from all around the world and let them come, speak English, assimilate, become part of the culture, and become Americans. He thinks that's fantastic. So when he looks at the competition, he says, well, gee, the Americans may have 7 billion minus 1.3, you know, to draw from. So and China is not able to do that because the Chinese language.
In other words, the U.S.
Chinese
can attract talent from the whole planet.
From the whole world.
China has so many barriers, starting with their language. He says he's told them they should actually make their dominant language
speak English. The way that he did in
China.
Singapore.
Yeah.
The way that he did in Singapore.
I don't think that's going to fly.
I'm sure the Chinese leader's jaw dropped, and he may have probably been smiling. Who knows?
But he's a pragmatist, and he sees that barrier as a problem for China ultimately. I mean, he says China will inevitably catch up to the U.S. in absolute GDP and surpass it. But in creativity, may never match America's because its culture does not permit a free exchange and contest of ideas. That's partly internal politics. That's partly open and closed doors, open and closed access. But there's this issue of what China will bring out to the world. And I'm so curious about it. Here he is. Again, this is March 2011. He's talking with Charlie Rose. He's aged some even since. And you can hear him aging even in this tape. But he's talking about China's attitude toward the rest of the world.
They do not believe that what works for them can work for other people. If you want to try my system, go ahead. But I have special circumstances that allowed me to build up the system. I'm not interested in changing regimes. I'll deal with you as you are, whether you're a dictatorship, whether you're a tribal leader, whatever. And we maintain good relations. I need your oil. I need your resources. Let's do business. There's no evangelistic urge to change things.
No evangelistic urge on China's part to change things around the world. But Robert Blackwell, that is a change in itself. The U.S., whatever you think of it, has for a long time had a kind of evangelistic posture toward trade and more, political values, human rights values, philosophical values. What does it mean if the number one power in the world doesn't really care how you do your business, whether you're good or bad, corrupt or you know, full of rectitude? What does that mean for the planet? What's he think?
Well, it changes the international system and the pressures on various countries. The Chinese make it clear when they go to a country and wish its minerals or its energy that they are completely indifferent to what that country does to its citizens, unlike the United States. And here, I think, is a point worth making strongly, which is up until 20 years ago, the Western model led by the United States was basically unchallenged in the world about how to organize societies, the role of the market, and so forth. What the Chinese have been able to do since Deng Xiaoping is use market mechanisms in an authoritarian state. And there are other countries which look at this and now debate whether that Western model, given America's economic difficulties, the problems in Europe with the euro and all the rest, whether that really is the best model for them. And it's not because the Chinese are out being evangelists. It's because, as Lee Kuan Yew says, the Chinese model for economic development works like no other model has ever worked in the world during this 30-year period. So naturally, other countries look at it and seek to replicate it, or at least think about replicating it. And the American model, on the other hand, of course, has been substantially tarnished by the American economic difficulties of the last 5 to 10 years.
Grandmaster strategist Lee Kuan Yew looking out at the world, the U.S. and China, as China surges to number one. Graham Allison, of course, Bob's right. It's been a long time that Americans, I mean, it for a long time, they saw their system as incredibly successful, and the rest of the world sort of lined up with our urging and by our example behind it. How does Lee Kuan Yew see the American response as they become not number one necessarily, maybe at best co-equal in terms of economic power and more? How does he think the U.S. will deal with a world that's not necessarily following its tune? And it's a different picture of a country that's sort of off, that we can be off fiddling with our democracy, doing what we want, and the rest of the world isn't doing it and maybe doesn't care if we are.
Well, I think he is extremely worried about that. He's not short America. He actually says, you know, people who say America is in systemic decline don't believe it. He believes in American resilience and the capacity to recover. He believes in American, as I said before, the openness, the competitiveness, the attraction.
But even recovery will only mean co-equal status, and we've got a chance of falling below
that. He's hoping for the recovery sooner rather than later, because the longer this goes on, the more this will be psychologically difficult for Americans. And then he also was quite clear that if you pan in the television to any American audience in any sporting event, they all hold up one finger, number one.
Sure.
So when China becomes larger than the U.S. as a GNP, it's going to be an event. And this is going to be in the next decade, most likely on the current track. So you look and you say, whoa, wait a minute. Well, then some Americans will say, well, it doesn't really matter whether your economy is bigger than mine because, you know, our per capita income is greater. But the answer is, if you're looking for a market, that's the market that's growing. If you're looking for trade, that's the trade that's growing. And it's a government that's prepared to use its economic instruments for influence. So this is going to require a huge attitude and action adjustment by Americans, and he's quite worried about it.
I mean, it reminds me of those giant lizards that turn toward the sun, right? Countries turn toward the sun. If China has more economic power, and they know this very well, he says, Bob Blackwell, they know it, they see it, they're working it already, they're letting countries know, hey, it's a harmonious rise, but we're the boss in this relationship, and we're keeping track of who thwarts us or doesn't.
Right, and they use the market. Would you like to have access to the market of 1.3 billion people over the long run or not? And we'd like you to have access to our market, they say, but of course that depends on the quality of our bilateral relationship. And then, of course, the subtext is, and that, of course, depends on whether you agree with us. When we were talking to him about America and American response, we asked him, because he is devoted to the United States concept of resiliency and all the rest, we asked him, what would shake your faith in your conviction that America will be resilient and will get past these current problems? And his answer was and is quite topical. He said, if whoever is the next president fills out that term, the next 4 years, without seriously dealing with the American debt and deficit problem, I will begin to wonder whether I am right about American resiliency.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the world's most senior statesman, strategist out of Asia, Lee Kuan Yew. In the new world of power he sees in the 21st century, China up, the U.S. uncertain, and what that will mean. My guests today have spent a lot of time interviewing the founder of Singapore, long its prime minister. Tough guy, Nick Kristof says, intolerance and authoritarianism have never had so articulate or stimulating a spokesman as Lee Kuan Yew, but he is smart, thoughtful, blunt, and provocative. He knows both of these countries well, and he's looking at a century with more change embedded in it already than most Americans are really paying attention to. Graham Allison is with us. Robert Blackwell, Ambassador Blackwell, former U.S. Ambassador to India. Response online here, Italo says, USA, meet your new masters. And without firing a shot, Thomas says the USA will be a timeshare for China. Max says we'll be another tributary state, just like in the old empire. Well, Lee Kuan Yew says, maybe be co-equals, America. Get on your game. Don't fight. Work together. You don't have much of a choice. And off we go. David's calling from Nashville, Tennessee. David, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking the call.
Yeah.
Read a book that changed my view of the world a few years ago. It was Charles Mann, 1493, and it talks about the beginning of the global economy between Europe and China. And I guess from reading that, I kind of maybe challenge or would like to get some perspective. At between the 16th and 18th century, it seems that China had probably half of what the world used as a common currency in silver and began to understand the arbitrage and changing silver for gold. And because of the silver crisis that happened, they lost their economic power because it began to flow out. But even in the 1400s, they had probably the most powerful navy in the world, but they used it for economic and not conquest purposes because they were generally focused on growing internally. But I guess I wanted to compare the rise in power of China, both economically in the world at that time, with what we have now. The growth was much slower over a longer period of time, but you had very slow travel, transport, and communications. And
right.
So if you were to maybe put that on the same pace, if they would have had the information age, because it just seems like this is ancient history for China, and they've been doing this very successfully for a while. They're patient. They have a long-term view. They're not imperially focused, at least on conquest. And just like to get some comments on that.
David, I appreciate your call. Of course, they fell in a hole so deep that it took them, centuries to get out of. And the West, for centuries, became the dominant world player. So it's not as though they're anything like infallible. What about China's historical experience of wielding power and what's relevant or not relevant there in the Lee Kuan Yew view? Graham?
Well, it's a great question, and I think the Chinese have a theory of the case in which China was the greatest power in the world naturally, as you said, Tom, earlier. The word China for them means center of civilization.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the civilization
literally means that.
That's what it means
yes.
by definition.
Yes.
So this is just kind of normal.
Yeah.
And the world that they knew, which was just their local world,
mm-hmm.
related to them not as co-equal powers ever.
Right.
But as vassals who came,
bring tribute,
who kowtowed, bring tribute.
Kneel.
They mm-hmm. didn't want to occupy them, so they were mm-hmm. not generally imperialistic. They mm-hmm. weren't in the sense of trying to be.
But and
they
yet wanted, it was an empire.
But they
of
wanted
a
certain degree of deference. Just mm-hmm. know your place, just mm-hmm. What Lee Kuan Yew said. So now,
But in the past, they didn't press their advantage to the max, maybe because their cultural perspective didn't give them.
Right.
I mean, the West did. They sent ships out to get nutmeg and take
right.
over Java before, you know.
No, they were always much more subtle, just exactly mm-hmm. as you said. Now, they have the theory that then what happened, this is the dominant Chinese theory, mm-hmm. that came colonialization and humiliation, and that's what they're recovering from to their natural status as number one.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, if you look at it in terms of economic well-being, they were extremely poor like everybody else in the world. For the first almost 4,000 years, everybody mm-hmm. had $1 or $2 per person.
Mm-hmm.
If they had more people, that added up to more money. But they were poor
and
miserable just like everybody
right,
else.
Right.
So what they missed out because of their xenophobia, and Lee Kuan Yew was very clear about this, and their arrogance was the Industrial Revolution. So when the British showed up there in the 1760s with all sorts of modern, you know, the first fruits of industrialization, mm-hmm. the Chinese said, well, there's nothing new here. We all know about this. We're perfectly fine. The Japanese adopted the Industrial Revolution, and
off.
Soon the Japanese mm-hmm. were dominating the Chinese. So I would say there's a bit of mythology about this restoration, but it certainly is deep in the culture.
What about, Bob, I mean, historically, it's true. They did not go out and become the great colonial power. But now we're in a globalized age. Now, whatever power you have, it flows quickly, economic or otherwise, to the other end of the globe. How does Lee Kuan Yew see China handling that in this century?
I think the caller was absolutely right in reminding us that China, and Graham has just spoken to this too, was a very powerful country 1,500 years ago. There's a dramatic point in which makes the emphasis in Chinese history in which their fleet was sailing to India and even around India,
Africa,
comes back, and the Chinese emperor orders the fleet burned, and it was burned because he said our future is on the Chinese Asian mainland. But the speaker also said at the end, and you just mentioned it too, Tom, that in this globalized age with IT and all the rest, the world now watches China's rise and the world reacts to it. So very different from 1,500 years ago. One last point about this, and I want to reemphasize something that was said earlier. I believe, and Lee Kuan Yew believes more to the point, mm-hmm. that America is completely unprepared for what's happening in Asia and the rise of Chinese power. And if you look at our morning newspapers, what dominates our perspective on foreign policy and international affairs? It's all political military. Should we bomb Iran?
Yep.
Should we use military force in Syria?
Mm-hmm.
We did in Libya and so forth. Lee Kuan Yew says the use of military force in those ways is becoming an antique phenomenon. And what's really going to shape the international system in the period ahead, at least the next 20 to 30 years, is economic power projection. And you Americans are still in the former era and haven't caught up with this as the dominant organizing principle in international relations for the foreseeable future.
We talk about China a fair bit on this show, and this is a part of the reason, because I just think it's so hard to really wake up to the significance of what's happening, not necessarily with the military terms with China, mm-hmm. but just in raw power terms from that economy and what that will mean for the world. It seems to me Americans just aren't taking on board the profundity of this shift. You can love China or hate China. It's happening, and it doesn't seem that we're fully alert to it, Graham.
I think you're precisely right, and I think that the U.S., for too many Americans, we assume that it is our God-given right to be number one. We are the dominant power. That's just natural, and that's permanent. And I think what Lee Kuan Yew, and I think the reason why it's so bracing, is while he admires hugely the U.S. and he's deeply desirous that the U.S. get its acts back together. If you look at the recent performance of the U.S., let's say not just since the financial crisis, mm-hmm. but the last 20 years, mm-hmm. I mean, the program you did recently on what's happened to the middle class mm-hmm. over this period in the U.S. Mm-hmm. Excuse me, in China, 600 million people have in the last three decades gone from abject poverty to being, moving towards the middle class. So you look and you say, well, gee, do people think their lives are getting better in China?
You bet.
A lot of people have seen in a single generation a hundredfold increase in their economic well-being. Well, that took 1,000 years in Europe. So from an American point of view, this is, and Lee Kuan Yew wants, I think, to be provocative by in-your-face, guys,
stop
wake
dithering,
up.
United
yeah,
States.
Wake up.
I mean, not that everything's perfect in China, far from it, but right. Look at the big curve here. Kate in Nashville, Tennessee. Kate, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm curious about the obstacles to what seems to be this inevitable success of China. Their population can't breathe. What are
yes.
they going to do about pollution?
Yeah.
What about the one child, the one child per family mm-hmm. issue. So what's going to get in their way?
The roadblocks, the potholes, the problems, and there are many. I mean, you talk about him talking about the disparity in income in China between the rich coastal cities and the inland provinces, the disparity in income even within cities, the potential for severe discontent and civil disorder. And that's even before you get to that soupy sky we've seen over Beijing recently, Bob.
It's a terrific question, and the Chinese leaders are preoccupied with exactly what the caller enumerates. So far, with all those problems, they've been able to manage their internal politics in ways that still produce this 10% growth. They have, though, the largest sustainable energy program now in the world. It's absolutely true that when one goes to Beijing, one has to worry about the capacity to breathe. But they know this is a problem and they're working on it. But Chinese, at least, maybe Americans would be different, if they have to choose between a clean environment and a 10% growth rate and 100% improvement in their standard of living, they don't have any problem in choosing. This party has been successful, at least thus far, in harnessing and dealing with, in brutal ways, the dissidents throughout the country. And you're absolutely right, there have been many. So that's one of the questions that arises. But Lee Kuan Yew thinks that despite all these problems, despite them, the Chinese leadership will be able to manage them in ways that allow them to continue this absolutely extraordinary economic growth, at least for the foreseeable future.
It may look unbearable, but there's always the compared to what. Let me get Mark in from Tulsa, Oklahoma. Mark, great to have you. Thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was just wanting to know what this means for the American workforce. In like the next 25 years, do we become stagnant with no job growth? And basically, can we look forward to being a service industry type country?
maybe service to China. Mark, let us pick it up. I mean, Graham, Lee Kuan Yew, as repeatedly said, he's incredibly admiring of the United States. He says, look, there was a time when Japan and Germany were taking all the manufacturing, and the next thing you know, there's Microsoft and Bill Gates and Apple and Steve Jobs and the internet, and America sort of does an end run, a leap of imagination and creativity again. What's he saying about the future? The U.S., find another one, get going? What about the jobs Mark's asking about?
Yeah, he finds it befuddling and very discouraging what we all refer to as the dysfunctionality of our government, given the objective balance sheet. If you look objectively at the balance sheet, he does a list of our advantages and our disadvantages relative to China or mm-hmm. India, and says there's no reason why the U.S. can't recover again the way that it did after we thought Japan was going to be mm-hmm. number one or after Germany. And he has a great list of the things. And he says, but what's wrong with us? I mean, how can it be the case that everybody can agree that you can't continue this spending that you're spending, creating the borrowing that you're borrowing with
poor
the deficits you're doing,
results.
With poor education, with lousy infrastructure. Mm-hmm. Excuse me, everybody knows how to do this. So what is happening?
What's
so
up with you, United
keeps,
States of America?
He keeps going back to this. And when he looked at the Chinese piece, as the earlier mm-hmm. question arose, he looks at their disadvantages. Demographic was mentioned. Language, mm-hmm. culture, which is conformist and which is reluctant to challenge authority, mm-hmm. which he sees in this new
anti-creativity in some ways.
Anti-creative, and they're mm-hmm. going to have the trouble, and he's worried about that in Singapore. He watched his grandson, who graduated from MIT 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. He told him, you know, he should come home and be part of the family business since his son is the
in
current
Singapore.
Prime Minister.
Yeah.
His son said, I'm going to go to work for Google. So he Google, yes.
So maybe there's the future, but you've got to have a whole country built up around that, to Mark's point.
Exactly. And he doesn't see any reason why that creativity that you see in those companies shouldn't be much more broadly spread in the U.S. Indeed, if you look at the set of assets for the U.S., I would say, except for our governance, we're doing fine.
Yeah. Interesting how all this is playing. Americans still a little bit disengaged from the changes that he's vividly describing here. The Chinese, not so. Your collection of his thinking has been on the market there. They're reading it. And I understand it's very controversial in China because he's saying it will be some decades before China's number one. And they don't want to believe that. They're hungrier. They want to go faster.
That's right. And the book is being read widely in China. But I want to return and just quote as we get near the end of on the caller's good question about jobs and the future of dealing with this phenomenon. Lee Kuan Yew's simple answer is it's up to the United States if it wishes to compete with China. But then he goes on and says this. He says, it scares me because many world leaders, including American, have not woken up to the peril that their populations are in, the melting ice cap. I expected great consternation. What would happen to this earth? But no. Has it triggered emergency meetings to do something about this? No. Earth warming, the glaciers melting away, it's not an election issue. Leave it to the next president.
Wake up, USA, on many fronts, says the great, grandmaster, as you guys have it, out of Singapore, Lee Kuan Yew. It is a wake-up call, and we hear it loud and clear in this hour. We're very grateful to the two of you for bringing it to us. United States, if you want your values to ride high, to say the very least, wake up. The book is Lee Kuan Yew, The Grandmaster's Insights on China, the United States, and the World. Robert Blackwell, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Graham Allison, thank you so much for joining us and putting it together. Tomorrow, we're going to look at this big asteroid that's going to brush by planet Earth on Friday, coming closer than our own satellites. Join us. We'll look at the world of asteroids out there and how close it's coming here. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Thank you.